Different circumstances, I might call it a conspiracy, but it's not. For a guy who says he's just trying to put things back together, Jack sure is doing a lot of new and crazy things. Crazy is a little strong, Bob. Not for them, it isn't. Everybody's saying he isn't one of us, and they're reacting strongly to his initiatives. Even you have to admit that his tax ideas are a little way off the usual playing field. But that's the excuse for what's happening. One of the excuses, anyway. The game's the same one it always was. A couple of leaks, and the manner of their presentation, that's what determines how it's played. Arnie had to nod. It was like highway littering. If someone dumped all the trash in the proper barrel, then things were neat, and the task was done in a few seconds. If that same someone tossed it all out the window of a moving car, then you had to spend hours picking it all up. The other side was now dumping the trash haphazardly, and the president was having to use his limited time doing wasteful and unproductive things instead of the real work of driving down the road. The simile was ugly, but apt. Politics was so often less about doing constructive work than about spreading garbage around for others to clean up. "Who leaked?" The reporter shrugged. "I can only guess. Somebody in the agency, probably somebody who's being riffed. You have to admit that building up the spy side of the house looks kind of Neanderthal. How far are they cutting the intelligence directorate?" "More than enough to compensate for the new field people. The idea is to save money overall, better information, more efficient overall performance, that sort of thing. I don't," he added, "tell the president how to do intelligence stuff. On that, he really is an expert." "I know that. I had my story almost ready to run. I was about to call you for an interview with him when the bubble broke." "Oh, and what was my angle?" "He's the most contradictory son of a bitch in this town. In some ways, he's brilliant. But in others, Babe in the Woods is charitable." "Go on." "I like the guy," Holtzman admitted. "For damn sure he's honest. Not relatively honest, really honest. I was going to tell it pretty much the way it was. You want to know what has me pissed?" He paused for a sip of the bourbon, hesitated again before proceeding, and then spoke with unconcealed anger. "Somebody at the Post leaked my story, probably to Ed Keelty. Then Keelty probably arranged a leak to Donner and Plummer."
"And they used your story to hang him?"
"Pretty much," Holtzman admitted. Van Damme nearly laughed. He held it back for as long as he could, but it was too delicious to resist. "Welcome to Washington, Bob." "You know, some of us really do take our professional ethics seriously," the reporter shot back, rather lamely. "It was a good story. I researched the hell out of it. I got my own source in CIA. Well, I have several, but I got a new one for this. Somebody who really knew the stuff. I took what he gave me, and I back-checked the hell out of it. Verified everything I could. Wrote the piece stating what I knew and what I thought. Careful to explain the difference at all times," he assured his host. "And you know, Ryan comes out looking pretty good." "Yeah, sure, sometimes he short-circuits the system, but the guy's never broken the rules, far as I can tell. If we ever have a major crisis, that's the guy I want in the Oval Office. But some son of a bitch took my story, my information from my sources, and played with it. I don't like that, Arnie. I have a public trust, too, and so does my paper. And somebody fucked with that." He set his drink down. "Hey, I know what you think about me and my—"
"No, you don't," Van Damme interrupted.
"But you've always—" "I'm the chief of staff, Bob. I have to be loyal to my boss, and so I have to play the game from my side. But if you think I don't respect the press, you're not as smart as you're supposed to be. We're not always friends. Sometimes we're enemies. But we need you as much as you need us. For Christ's sake, if I didn't respect you, why the hell are you drinking my booze?"
It was either an elegant role or a truthful statement, Holtzman thought, and Arnie was too skillful a player for him to tell the difference right off. But the smart thing to do was finish the drink, which he did. A pity that his host preferred cheap booze to go along with his L.L. Bean shirts. Arnie didn't know how to dress, either. Or maybe that was a considered part of his mystique. The political game was so intricate as to be a cross between classical metaphysics and experimental science. You could never know it all, and finding out one part, as often as not, denied you the ability to find out another equally important part. But that was why it was the best game in town. Okay, Arnie, I'll accept that. Good of you. Van Damme smiled and refilled the glass. So why did you call me? It's almost embarrassing. Another pause. I will not participate in the public hanging of an innocent man. You've done that before, Arnie objected. Well, maybe so, but they were all politicians, and they all had it coming in one way or another. I don't know what... Okay, how about I'm not into child abuse? Ryan deserves a fair chance. And you're pissed about losing your story and the Pulitzer that... I have two of them already, Holtzman reminded him. Otherwise, he would have been taken off the story by his managing editor. But internal politics at the Washington Post were as vicious as those elsewhere in the city. So? So I need to know about Columbia. I need to know about Jimmy Cutter and how he died. Jesus, Bob, you don't know what our ambassador went through down there today. Great language for invective, Spanish. A reporter smiled. The story can't be told, Bob. It just can't. The story will be told. It's just a question of who tells it, and that will determine how it's told. Arnie, I know enough now to write something, okay? As so often happened in Washington at times like this, everyone was trapped by circumstance. Holtzman had a story to write. Doing it the right way would perhaps resurrect his original story, put him in the running for another Pulitzer. It was still important to him, previous denials notwithstanding, and Arnie knew it. And tell whoever had leaked his story to Ed Keelty that he or she had better leave the Post before Holtzman nailed that name down and wrecked his or her career with a few well-placed whispers and more than a few dead-end assignments. Arnie was trapped by his duty to protect his president, and the only way to do it was to violate the law and his president's trust. There had to be an easier way, the chief of staff thought, to earn a living. He could have made Holtzman wait for his decision, but that would have been mere theatrics, and both men were past that. No notes, no tape recorder. Off the record, senior official, not even senior administration official, Bob agreed. And I can tell you who to confirm it with. They know it all? Even more than I do, Van Damme told him. Hell, I just found out about the important part. A raised eyebrow. That's nice, and the same rules will apply to them. Who really knows about this? Even the president doesn't know it all. I'm not sure if anybody knows it all. Holtzman took another sip. It would be his last. Like a doctor in an operating room, he didn't believe in mixing alcohol and work. Flight 534 touched down at Istanbul at 2:55 a.m. local time, after a flight of 1,270 miles and 3 hours 15 minutes. The passengers were groggily awake, having been roused by the cabin staff 30 minutes earlier, and told to put their seat backs to the upright position in a series of languages. The landing was smooth, and a few of them raised the plastic shades on the windows to see that they were indeed on the ground at one more anonymous piece of real estate with white runway lights and blue taxiway lights, just like those all over the world. Those getting out stood at the proper time to stumble off into the Turkish night. The rest pushed their seats back for another snooze during the 45-minute layover before the aircraft left yet another gate at 3:40 a.m., for the second half of the trip. Lufthansa 601 was a European-made Airbus 310 twin jet, roughly the same as the KLM Boeing in size and capacity. This one, too, had 5 travelers aboard and left its gate at 2:55 for the nonstop flight to Frankfurt. The departure was routine in all details. That's some story, Arnie. Oh, yeah, I didn't know the important parts until this week. How sure are you of this? Holtzman asked. The pieces all fit.
He shrugged again.
I can't say I liked hearing it. I think we would have won the election anyway, but Jesus, the guy threw it.
He tanked on a presidential election, but you know, Van Damme said wistfully, that might have been the most courageous and generous political act of the century. I didn't think he had it in him.
Does Fowler know?
I haven't told him. Maybe I should.
Wait a minute. Remember how Liz Elliott planted a story on me about Ryan and how...
Yes, that all folds into this.
Jack went down personally to get those soldiers out. The guy next to him in the chopper was killed, and he's looked after the family ever since. Liz paid for it. She came apart the night the bomb went off in Denver.
And Jack really did?
You know, that's one story that never came out all the way. Fowler lost it and almost launched a missile at Iran. It was Ryan, wasn't it? He's the one who stopped it.
Holtzman looked down at his drink and decided on another sip.
How?
He got onto the hotline, Arnie replied.
He cut the president off and talked directly with Narmanoff, and persuaded him to back things off some. Fowler flipped out and told the Secret Service to go arrest him. But by the time they got to the Pentagon, things were calmed down. It worked, thank God.
It took Holtzman a minute or so to absorb that, but again the story fit with the fragments he knew. Fowler had resigned 2 days later, a broken man, but an honorable one who knew that his moral right to govern his country had died with his order to launch a nuclear weapon at an innocent city. And Ryan had also been shaken by the event, badly enough to leave government service at once, until Roger Derling had brought him back in.
Ryan's broken every rule there is, almost as if he likes it.
But that wasn't fair, was it?
If he hadn't, we might not be here.
The chief of staff poured himself another. Holtzman waved him off.
You see what I mean about the story, Bob? If you tell it all, the country gets hurt.
But then why did Fowler recommend Ryan to Roger Derling, the reporter asked. He couldn't stand the guy, and...
Whatever his faults, and he has them, Bob Fowler is an honest politician, that's why.
No, he doesn't like Ryan personally. Maybe it's chemistry, I don't know. But Ryan saved him, and he told Roger...
What was it?
Good man in a storm.
That's it, Arnie remembered.
Shame he doesn't know politics.
He learns pretty fast. Might surprise you.
He's going to gut the government if he gets the chance. I mean, I do like the guy personally, but his policies... Every time I think I have him figured out, he swerves on me. And then I have to remind myself that he doesn't have an agenda, Van Damme said. He just does the job. I give him papers to read, and he acts on them. He listens to what people tell him, asks good questions, and always listens to the answers. But he makes his own decisions as though he knows what's right and what's wrong. But the hell of it is, mostly he does. Bob, he's rolled me. But that's not it either. Sometimes I'm not sure what it is with him, you know.
A total outsider, Holtzman observed quietly, but...
The chief of staff nodded.
Yeah, but...
But he's being analyzed as though he's an insider with a hidden agenda, and they're playing the insider games as if they apply to him, but they don't.
So the key to the guy is there's nothing to figure out.
Son of a bitch, Bob concluded.
He hates the job, doesn't he?
Most of the time. You should have been there when he spoke in the Midwest. He got it then. All those people loving him, and he loved them back, and it showed, and it scared the shit out of him.
Nothing to figure out?
Exactly.
Like they say in golf, the hardest thing to do is to hit a straight ball, right?
Everybody's looking for curves. There aren't any.
Holtzman snorted.
So what's the angle if there isn't an angle?
Bob, I just try to control the media, remember?
Damned if I know how you report this, except to state the facts.
You know, like you're supposed to do.
That was a lot for the journalist to take. He'd been in Washington for all of his professional life. And every politician is supposed to be like Ryan, but they're not.
This one is, Arnie shot back.
How am I supposed to tell my readers that? Who'll believe it?
Ain't that the problem, he breathed. I've been in politics all my life, and I thought I knew it all. Hell, I do know it all. I'm one of the best operators ever was. Everybody knows that. And all of a sudden, this yahoo comes into the Oval Office and says the Emperor's naked. And he's right. And nobody knows what to do about it except to say that he isn't. The system isn't ready for this. The system is only ready for itself.
And the system will destroy anybody who says different. Holtzman snorted with the thought.
If Hans Christian Andersen had written the Emperor's clothes about Washington, then the kid who'd spoken the truth out loud would have been killed on the spot by the assembled crowd of insiders.
It'll try, Arnie agreed.
And what are we supposed to do about it?
You're the one who said that you don't want to officiate at the hanging of an innocent man, remember?
Where's that leave us?
Maybe to talk about the unruly mob, Arnie suggested. Or the Emperor's corrupt court.
Next to go was Austrian Airlines 774. It was down to a routine now, and the arrangements were well within the technical parameters. The cans of shaving cream had been filled a bare 40 minutes before departure. The proximity of the monkey house to the airport helped, as did the time of day. And having people race the last few 100 meters to the gate was not unusual anywhere in the world, particularly for flights like this one. The soup was sprayed into the bottom of the can by a plastic valve that was invisible to X-ray examination. The nitrogen went in the top to a separate insulated container located in the center of the cans. The process was clean and safe. For extra but really unnecessary safety, the cans were sprayed and wiped. That was just to make the travelers happy. The cans were quite cold, of course, though not dangerously so. As the liquid nitrogen boiled off, it would vent through a pressure valve into the ambient atmosphere, where it merely joined the air. Though nitrogen is an important element in explosives, by itself it is totally inert, clear, and odorless. Nor would it react chemically with the contents of the cans. And so the pressure relief valve retained a precise quantity of the warming gas to act as a safe propellant for the soup when the time came. The filling was done by the medical corpsmen in their protective suits. They refused to work without them, and ordering them otherwise would only have made them nervous and sloppy. And so the director indulged their fears. Two groups of five remained to be done. The cans could really all have been prepared at the same time, Maori knew, but no unnecessary chances were being taken, a thought that made him stop cold. No unnecessary chances? Sure.
Daryai didn't sleep that night, which was unusual for him. Though with increasing years he found that he needed less of it, getting off to sleep had never been difficult for him. On a really quiet night, if the winds were right, he could hear the airliners bring their engines to the roar of takeoff power. A distant sound, rather like a waterfall, he sometimes thought, or perhaps an earthquake. Some fundamental sound of nature, distant and foreboding. And now he found himself listening for it, and with his imagination wondering if he heard it or not. Had he gone too fast? He was an old man in a country where so many died young. He remembered the diseases of his youth, and later he'd learned their scientific causes, mainly poor water and sanitation. For Iran had been a backward country for most of his lifetime, despite its long history of civilization and power. Then it had been resurrected by oil, and the immense riches that had come with it. Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, Shah and Shah, King of Kings, the phrase proclaimed, had begun to raise the country, but made the mistake of moving too fast and making too many enemies. In Iran's dark age, as in every other such time, secular power had devolved to the Islamic clergy, and in liberating the nation's peasantry, he'd trod on too many toes, making enemies of people whose power was spiritual, and to whom the common folk looked for order in lives made chaotic by change. Even so, the Shah had almost succeeded, but not quite.
and not quite, was as damning a curse as the world produced for those who would be great. What did such men think? Just as he himself was old, so the Shah had grown old and sick with cancer, and watched the work of a lifetime evaporate in a matter of weeks, his associates executed in a brief orgy of settled scores, bitter at his betrayal by his American friends. Had he thought that he'd gone too far? Or not far enough? Daryai didn't know. And now he would have liked to know, as he listened for the distant sounds of waterfalls in the still of a Persian night. To move too fast was a grievous error, which the young learned and the old knew. But not to move enough, fast enough, far enough, strongly enough, that was what really denied goals to those who would be great. How bitter it must be to lie in bed, without the sleep one needed to think clearly, and wonder and curse oneself for chances missed and chances lost. Perhaps he knew what the Shah had thought, Daryai admitted to himself. His own country was drifting again. Even insulated as he was, he knew the signs. It showed up as subtle differences in dress, especially the dress of women. Not much, not quite enough for his true believers to persecute them, for even the true believers had softened their devotion, and there were gray areas into which people could venture to see what might happen. Yes, the people still believed in Islam, and yes, they still believed in him. But really the Holy Quran wasn't that strict, and their nation was rich, and to grow richer it needed to do business. How could it be a champion of the faith unless it grew richer after all? The best and brightest of Iran's young went abroad to be educated, for his country did not possess the schools that the infidel West had, and for the most part they came back, educated in skills which his country needed. But they also came back with other things, invisible, doubts and questions, and memories of a freewheeling life in a different society, where the pleasures of the flesh were available to the weak, and all men were weak. What if all Khomeini and he had accomplished was to delay what the Shah had started? The people who had come back to Islam in reaction to Pahlavi were now drifting back to the promise of freedom he'd offered them. Didn't they know? Didn't they see? They could have all the trappings of power and all the blessings of what people called civilization, and still remain faithful, still have the spiritual anchor, without which all was nothing. But to have all that, his country needed to be more than it was, and so he could not afford to be not quite. Daryai had to deliver the things that would show he'd been right all along, that uncompromising faith was the true root of power. The assassination of the Iraqi leader, the misfortune that had befallen America, these things had to be a sign, didn't they? He'd studied them carefully. Now Iraq and Iran were one, and that had been the quest of decades. And at virtually the same instant, America had been crippled. It wasn't just Badrine who was telling him things. He had his own America experts who knew the workings of that country's government. He knew Ryan from a single important meeting, had seen his eyes, heard the bold but hollow words, and so he knew the measure of the man who might be his principal adversary. He knew that Ryan had not, and by the laws of his country could not, have a replacement selected for himself. And so there was only this moment, and he had to act in it, or else assume for himself the curse of not quite. No, he would not be remembered as another Mohammed Pahlavi. If he did not covet the trappings of power, he lusted for the fact of it. Before his death, he would lead all Islam. In a month he would have the oil of the Persian Gulf and the keys to Mecca, secular and spiritual power. From that his influence would expand in all directions. In but a few years, his country would be a superpower in every way, and he would leave to his successors a legacy such as the world hadn't seen since Alexander,
but with the added security that it was founded in the words of God. To achieve that end, to unite Islam, to fulfill the will of Allah and the words of the Prophet Muhammad, he would do what was needed, and if that meant moving fast, then he would move fast. Overall, the process was a simple one, three simple steps, the third and most difficult of which was already established, and nothing could stop, even if Bedrine's plans all failed completely. Was he moving too fast? Daryai asked himself for the last time. No, he was moving decisively, with surprise, with calculation, with boldness. That was what history would say.
Flying at night is a big deal, Jack asked.
Sure is. For them it is, Robbie replied.
He liked briefing the president this way, late evening in the Oval Office, with a drink.
They've always been more parsimonious with equipment than they are with people. Helicopters, French ones in this case, same model the Coast Guard has a bunch of, cost money, and we haven't seen much in the way of night operations. The operation they're running is heavy on ASW. So maybe they're thinking about dealing with all those Dutch subs the Republic of China bought last year. We're also seeing a lot of combined operations with their Air Force.
Conclusion?
They're training up for something.
The Pentagon's Director of Operations closed his briefing book.
Sir, we...
Robbie, Ryan said, looking over the new reading glasses Kathy had just gotten him. If you don't start calling me Jack when we're alone, I'm going to break you back to Ensign by executive order.
We're not alone, Admiral Jackson objected, nodding toward Agent Price.
Andrea doesn't count.
Oh, shit, I mean...
Ryan blushed.
He's right, Admiral, I don't count, she said, with a barely contained laugh. Mr. President, I've been waiting weeks for you to say that.
Jack looked down at the table and shook his head. This is no way for a man to live. Now my best friend calls me sir, and I'm being impolite to a lady.
Jack, you are my commander-in-chief, Robbie pointed out, with a relaxed grin at his friend's discomfort. And I'm just a poor sailor man.
First things first, the president thought.
Agent Price?
Yes, Mr. President.
Pour yourself a drink and sit down.
Sir, I'm on duty, and regulations...
Well, then make it a light one,
but that's an order from your president. Do it.
She actually hesitated, but then decided that POTUS was trying to make some sort of point. Price poured a large thimbleful of whiskey into the old-fashioned glass and added a lot of ice and Evian to it. Then she sat next to the J-3. His wife, Sissy, was upstairs in the house with the Ryan family.
As a practical matter, people, the president needs to relax, and it's easier for me to do that if I don't make ladies stand up and my friend can call me by my name once in a while. Are we agreed on that?
Aye, aye, Robbie said, still smiling but seeing the logic and desperation of the moment.
Yes, Jack, we are all relaxed now, and we will enjoy it.
He looked over at Price.
You're here to shoot me if I misbehave, right?
Right in the head, she confirmed.
I prefer missiles myself.
Safer, he added.
You did okay with a shotgun one night, or so the boss has told me.
By the way, thanks.
Huh?
For keeping him alive. We actually like taking care of the boss, even if he gets too familiar with the hired help.
Jack freshened his drink while they relaxed on the other sofa. Remarkable, he thought. For the first time, there was a genuinely relaxed atmosphere in the office, to the point that two people could joke about him, right in front of him, as though he were a human being instead of POTUS.
I like this a lot better.
The president looked up.
Robbie, this gal has been around more crap than we have, listened in on all sorts of things. She has a master's degree, she's smart, but I'm supposed to treat her like she's a knuckle-dragger.
Well, hell, I'm just a fighter jock with a bad knee.
And I still don't know what the hell I'm supposed to be.
Andrea?
Yes, Mr. President.
Getting her to call him by his name was an impossible goal, Jack knew.
China, what do you think?
I think I'm no expert. But since you ask, I don't know.
You're expert enough, Robbie observed with a grunt. All the king's horses and all the king's men don't know much either.
The additional subs are arriving, he told the president. Mancuso wants them on the north-south line between the two navies. I've concurred on that, and the secretary signed off on it.
How's Brentano doing?
He knows what he doesn't know, Jack. He listens to us on operational stuff, asks good questions, and listens some more. He wants to start getting out into the field next week, poke around and see the kids at work to educate himself. His managerial skills are downright awesome, but he's swinging a big axe. He's going to, that is. I've seen his draft plan for downsizing the bureaucracy.
Whoa, Admiral Jackson concluded, with an eye roll.
You have problems with that? Jack asked.
No way. It's about 50 years overdue.
Miss Price, I'm an operator, he explained. I like greasy flight suits and the smell of jet fuel and pulling G's.
But us guys at the sharp end always have the desk sitters after us like a bunch of little dogs at our ankles all the time. Brentano loves engineers and people who do things, but along the way he's learned to hate bureaucrats and cost accountants. My kind of guy.
Back to China, Ryan said.
Okay, we still have the electronics intelligence flights working out of Kadena. We're getting routine training stuff. We do not know what intentions the Chi-Coms have. CIA isn't giving us much. Signal intelligence is unremarkable. State says that their government says what's the big deal, and that's it.
The Taiwanese Navy is big enough to handle the threat if there is one, unless they get cold-cocked. That's not going to happen. They are bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, doing their own training ops, a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing I can make out.
The Gulf?
Well, we're hearing from our people in Israel that they're taking a very close look, but I gather they're not getting much in the way of hard intel. Whatever sources they had were probably with the generals who bugged out to Sudan. Aides and such, probably. I got a fax in from Sean Magruder.
Who's that? Ryan asked.
He's an army colonel, boss man of the 10th Cav in the Negev. I met him last year. He's a guy we listen to. Most dangerous man in the world is what our good pal Avi Ben Jacob says of Darii. Magruder thought that was insightful enough to pass it along.
And?
And we need to keep an eye on it. It's probably a ways off, but Darii has imperial ambitions. The Saudis are playing it wrong. We should have people on the way over now, maybe not many, but some, to show the other side that we're in the game.
I talked to Ali about that. His government wants to cool it.
Wrong signal, Jackson observed.
Agreed, POTUS nodded. We'll work on that.
What's the state of the Saudi military? Price asked.
Not as good as it ought to be. After the Persian Gulf War, it got fashionable to join their National Guard, and they bought equipment like it was a bunch of Mercedes cars from a wholesaler. For a while, they had themselves a fine old time playing soldier, but then they found out that you have to maintain the stuff. They hired people to do that for them. Kinda like squires and knights back in the old days.
Ain't the same, Jackson said.
And now they're not training.
Oh, sure, they run around in their tanks, and they do their gunnery. The M1 is a fun tank to shoot, and they do a lot of that. But they're not training in units.
Knights and squires.
Their tradition is guys on horses going after other guys on horses. One-on-one, like in the movies. War ain't like that. War is a great big team working together. Their culture and history are against that model, and they haven't had the chance to learn. Bottom line, they're not as good as they think they are. If the UIR gets its military acts together someday and comes south, the Saudis are outgunned and damn sure outmanned.
How do we fix that? Ryan asked.
For starters, get some of our people over there, and some of their people over here, out to the National Training Center for a crash course in reality. I've talked it over with Mary Diggs at the NTC.
Mary?
General Marion Diggs.
Mary goes back to the point. It's a uniform thing, Robbie told Price. I'd like to fly a Saudi heavy battalion over here and have the Op 4 pound them into the sand for a few weeks to get the message across. That's how our people learned. That's how the Israelis learned. And that's how the Saudis are going to have to learn. Damn sight easier that way than in a shooting war. Diggs is for it big time. Give us 2 or 3 years, maybe less if we set up a proper training establishment in Saudi, and we can snap their army into shape. Except for politics, he added. POTUS nodded. Yeah, it'll make the Israelis nervous, and the Saudis have always worried about having too strong a military for domestic reasons. You could tell them the story about the three little pigs. It might not fly with their culture, but the big bad wolf just moved in next door to them, and they'd better start paying attention before he starts a huffin' and a puffin'. I hear you, Robbie. I'll have Adler and Vasco think that one over. Ryan checked his watch. Another 15-hour day. One more drink would have been nice, but as it was, he'd be lucky to get 6 hours of sleep, and he didn't want to wake up with a larger headache than necessary. He set his drink down and waved for the other two to follow down the ramp and out the door. Swordsman heading to the residence, Andrea spoke into her radio mic. A minute later, they were in the elevator and going up. "Try not to let the booze show," Jack remarked to his principal agent. "What are we going to do with you?" she asked the ceiling as the doors opened. Jack walked out first, leaving the other two behind as he took his jacket off. He hated wearing a jacket all the time. "Well, now you know," Robbie said to the Secret Service agent. She turned to look in his eyes. "Yeah. Actually, she'd known for quite a while. But she kept learning more and more about Swordsman. Take good care of him, Price. When he escapes from this place, I want my friend back." The Vagaries of Winds made the Lufthansa flight first to arrive at the international terminal in Frankfurt, Germany. For the travelers, it was like an inverted funnel. The jetway was the narrow part, and on entering the concourse they all spread out, checking the video monitors for their gates. The layovers ranged from 1 to 3 hours, and their luggage would be automatically transferred from one aircraft to another. For all the complaints about airport luggage handlers, 99.9% is a passing grade in most human endeavors. And the Germans were notoriously efficient. Customs control points didn't worry them, because none of them were spending any more time in Europe than was necessary. They studiously avoided eye contact, even when three of them entered a coffee shop, and all three, on reflection, decided on decaf. Two walked into the men's rooms for the usual reason, and then looked into the mirrors to check their faces. They'd all shaved just before leaving, but one of them, especially heavily bearded, saw that his jaw was already shadowed. Perhaps he should shave? Not a good idea, he thought, smiling at the mirror. Then he lifted his carry-on bag and walked off to the first-class lounge to wait for the flight to Dallas-Fort Worth. "Long day?" Jack asked, after everyone had gone home, and just the usual squad of guards patrolled outside. "Yeah. Grand rounds tomorrow with Bernie. Some procedures the next day, though." Kathy changed into her nightgown, as tired as her husband was. "Anything new?" "Not in my shop. Had lunch with Pierre Alexander. He's a new associate professor working under Ralph Forster, ex-army. Pretty smart." "Infectious diseases?" Jack vaguely remembered meeting the guy at some function or other. "AIDS and stuff?" "Yeah." "Nasty," Ryan observed, getting into bed. "They just dodged a bullet. There was a mini-outbreak of Ebola in Zaire," Kathy said, getting in the other side. "Two deaths. Then two more cases turned up in Sudan. But it doesn't look like it's going anywhere." "Is that as bad as people say?" Jack turned the light off. 80% mortality. Pretty bad. She adjusted the covers and moved toward him. "But enough of that stuff. Sissy says she's got a concert scheduled for 2 weeks from now at Kennedy Center. Beethoven's Fifth, with Fritz Bayerlein conducting, would you believe? Think we can get tickets?"
He could sense his wife's smile in the dark.
I think I know the theater owner. I'll see what I can do.
A kiss. A day ended. See you in the morning, Jeff. Price went to the right for her car. Raymond went to the left for his. A mind could be dulled by this job, Arif Raymond told himself. The sheer mechanics of it, the hours, the watching and waiting and doing nothing, but always being ready. Why should he complain about that? It was the story of his adult life. He drove north, waited for the security gate to open, and headed northwest. The empty streets made it go quickly. By the time he got to his home, the bled-off stress of working the detail in the White House had him nodding, but there were still mechanics. Unlocking the door, he next turned off the security system, picked up the mail that had come through the slot in the door, and scanned it. One bill, and the rest was junk mail, offering him the chance of a lifetime to buy things he didn't need. He hung up his coat, removed the pistol and holster from his belt, and walked into the kitchen. The light was blinking on the answering machine. There was one message. "Mr. Sloan," the digital recorder said to him in a voice that was familiar, though he'd only heard it once before, "this is Mr. Alahad. Your rug just came in and is ready for delivery." Chapter 37. Discharges. America was sleeping when they boarded their flights in Amsterdam and London and Vienna and Paris. This time, no two were on the same aircraft, and the schedules were staggered so that the same customs inspector would not have the chance to open two shaving kits and find the same brand of cream and then wonder about it, however unlikely that might be. The real risk had been in placing so many men on the same flights out of Tehran, but they'd been properly briefed on how to act. While the ever-watchful German police, for example, might have taken note of a gaggle of Middle Eastern men huddling together after arriving on the same flight, airports have always been anonymous places full of semi-confused, wandering people, often tired and usually disoriented, and one lonely, aimless traveler looked much like another. The first to board a transatlantic flight walked onto a Singapore Airlines 747 at Amsterdam Schiphol International Airport. Coded as SQ-26, the airliner pulled away at 8:30 a.m. and got into the air on time, then angled northwest for a great circle course that would take it over the southern tip of Greenland. The flight would last just under 8 hours. The traveler was in a first-class window seat, which he tilted all the way back. It was not even 3 in the morning in his next destination city, and he preferred sleep to a movie, along with most of the other people in the nose of the aircraft. He had his itinerary memorized, and if his memory failed, with the confusion of long-distance travel, he still had his tickets to remind him of what to do next. For the moment, sleep was enough, and he turned his head on the pillow, soothed by the swish of passing air outside the double windows. Around him in the air were other flights, with other travelers heading for Boston, Philadelphia, Washington, Dulles, Atlanta, Orlando, Dallas-Fort Worth, Chicago, San Francisco, Miami, and Los Angeles, the 10 principal gateway cities into America. Each of them had a trade show or convention of some sort underway now. 10 other cities, Baltimore, Pittsburgh, St. Louis, Nashville, Atlantic City, Las Vegas, Seattle, Phoenix, Houston, and New Orleans, also had events, and each was but a brief flight, in 2 cases a drive, from the nearest port of entry. The traveler on SQ-26 thought about that as he faded off. The shaving kit was tucked in his carry-on bag under the seat in front of him, carefully insulated and wrapped, and he made certain that his feet didn't touch, much less kick, the bag. It was approaching noon outside Tehran. The movie star watched as his group conducted weapons practice. It was a formality, really, designed more for morale than anything else.
They all knew how to shoot, having learned and practiced in the Bekaa Valley. And though they weren't using the same weapons they'd have in America, it didn't really matter. A gun was a gun, and targets were targets, and they knew about both. They couldn't simulate everything, of course, but all of them knew how to drive, and they spent hours every day going over the diagram and the models. They would go in during the late afternoon when parents came in to pick up their children for the daily trip home, when the bodyguards would be tired and bored from a day of watching the children do childish things. Movie Star had gotten descriptions of several of the regular cars, and some were common types which could be rented. The opposition was as trained and experienced as they had to be, but they were not supermen. Some were even women. And for all his exposure to the West, the movie star could not take women seriously as adversaries, guns or no guns. But their biggest tactical advantage was that his team was willing to use deadly force with profligate abandon. With over 20 toddlers about, plus the school staff, and probably a few parents in the way as well, the opposition would be greatly hampered. So no, the initial part of the mission was the easiest. The hard part would be getting away, if things got that far. He had to tell his team that they would get away, and that there was a plan. But really it didn't matter, and in their hearts all of them knew it. They were all willing to become sacrifices in the unannounced jihad, else they would never have joined Hezbollah in the first place. They were also willing to see their victims as sacrifices, but that was just a convenient label. Religion was really nothing more than a facade for what they did and who they were. A true scholar of their religion would have blanched at their purpose. But Islam had many adherents, and among them were many who chose to read the scriptures in unconventional ways. And they too had their following. What Allah might have thought of their actions was not something they considered very deeply, and the movie star didn't trouble himself to think about it at all. For him, it was business, a political statement, a professional challenge, one more task to occupy his days. Perhaps, too, it was a step toward a larger goal, the achievement of which would mean a life of comfort, and perhaps even some personal power and stability. But in his heart, he didn't really believe that either. At first, yes, he'd thought that Israel might be overthrown, the Jews expunged from the face of the earth, but those careless beliefs of his youth had long since faded. For him it was all mere process now, and this was one more task. The substance of the task didn't really matter all that much, did it? He asked himself, watching the team's grimly enthusiastic faces as the men hit the targets. Oh, it seemed to matter to them, but he knew better. The day began at 5:30 a.m. for Inspector Patrick O'Day. A clock radio roused him from his bed, then off to the bathroom for the usual start-up functions, a look in the mirror, and off to the kitchen to get the coffee going. It was the quiet of the day. Most people, the sensible ones, weren't up yet. No traffic on the streets. Even the birds still slumbering on their perches. Outside to get the papers, he could feel the silence and wonder why the world wasn't always this way. Through the trees to the east was the glow of a coming dawn, though the stronger of the stars still burned overhead. Not a single light showing in the rest of the houses in the development. Damn, was he the only one who had to work such punishing hours? Back inside, he took 10 minutes to scan the Morning Post and Sun. He kept track of the news, especially crime cases. As a roving inspector working directly out of the office of the director, he never knew from one day to the next when he might be sent off on a case, which often meant calling in a sitter, to the point that he sometimes thought about getting a full-time nanny. He could afford it. The insurance settlement for his wife's death in the plane crash had actually given him a measure of financial independence, though its circumstances seemed altogether blasphemous. But they had offered it, and he, on advice of counsel, had taken it. But a nanny? No. It would be a woman,
and Megan would think of her as Mommy. And no, he couldn't have that. Instead, he did the hours and denied himself so that he could be both parents, and no grizzly bear had ever been more protective of a cub. Maybe Megan didn't know the difference. Maybe kids thrived under the care of a mother and bonded firmly to her, but could as easily bond to a father. When asked about her mommy by other kids, she explained that Mommy had gone to heaven early. And this is my daddy. Whatever the psychological circumstances, the closeness of the two which seemed so natural to Megan, she'd scarcely had the chance to know anything else, was something that occasionally brought tears to her father's eyes. The love of a child is ever unconditional, all the more so when there is but one object for it. Inspector O'Day was sometimes grateful for the fact that he hadn't worked a kidnapping in years. Were he to do so today, he took a sip of coffee and admitted to himself that he might just find himself searching for an excuse not to bring the subject in. There were always ways. He'd worked on 6 of those cases as a young agent. Kidnapping for money was a very rare crime today. The word had gotten out that it was a losing game, that the full power of the FBI descended on such cases like the wrath of God. And only now did he understand how hateful such crimes were. You had to be a parent. You had to know the feel of tiny arms around your neck to understand the magnitude of such a violation. But then your blood turned to ice, and you didn't so much turn off your emotions as block them out for as long as you had to before letting them free again. He remembered his first squad supervisor, Dominic DiNapoli. The toughest wop this side of the Gambino family was the office joke, crying like a baby himself as he carried the living victim of such a crime to see her parents. Only now did he understand how it was just one more sign of Dom's toughness. Yeah, and that subject would never get out of Atlanta Federal Penitentiary. Then it was time to get Megan up. She was curled up in her full body sleeper, the blue one with Casper the Friendly Ghost on it. She was outgrowing it, he saw. Her little toes were pushing at the plastic feet. They did grow so fast. He tickled her nose and her eyes opened. "Daddy." She sat up, then stood to give him a kiss. And Pat wondered how kids woke up with a smile. No adult ever did. And the day began in earnest with another trip to the bathroom. He noted with pleasure that her training pants were dry. Megan was catching on to sleeping through the night. It had been a struggle for a while. Though it seemed a very strange thing to be proud about, he thought. He started to shave, a daily event that utterly fascinated his daughter. Done, he bent down so that she could feel his face and pronounce it, "Okay." Dinner this morning was oatmeal with sliced banana and a glass of apple juice, and watching the Disney Channel on the kitchen TV while Daddy returned to his paper. Megan took her bowl and glass to the dishwasher all by herself, a very serious task which she was learning to master. The hard part was getting the bowl into the holder properly. Megan was still working on that. It was harder than doing her own shoes, which had Velcro closures. Mrs. Daggett had told him that Megan was an unusually bright child, one more thing to beam with pride about, followed by the sadness always of remembering his wife. Pat told himself that he could see Deborah's face in hers, but the honest part of the agent occasionally wondered how much of that was a wish and how much fact. At least she seemed to have her mother's brains. Maybe the bright expression was what he saw. The ride in the truck was routine. The sun was up now and the traffic still light. Megan was in her safety seat, as usual looking at the other cars with wonderment. The arrival was routine also. There was the agent working in the 7-Eleven, of course, plus the advance team at Giant Steps. Well, nobody would ever kidnap his little girl. At the working level, rivalry between the Bureau and the service largely disappeared, except for the occasional inside joke or two. He was glad they were there. and they didn't mind having this armed man come in. He walked Megan in, and she immediately ran off to hug Mrs. Daggett and put her blankie in her cubby in the back, and her day of learning and play began. "Hey, Pat," the agent at the door greeted him. "Morning, Norm." Both men enjoyed an early morning yawn. "Your schedule's as screwed up as mine," Special Agent Jeffers replied. He was one of the agents who rotated on and off the sandbox detail, this morning working as part of the advance team. "How's the wife?" "6 more weeks, and then we have to think about shopping for a place like this. Is she as good as she seems?" "Mrs. Daggett? Ask the president," O'Day joked. "They've sent all their kids here." "I guess it can't be too bad," the Secret Service man agreed. "What's the story on the Chiulte case?" "Somebody at State is lying. That's what the OPR guys think," he shrugged. "Not sure which. The polygraph data was worthless. You guys picking up on anything?" "You know, it's funny. He sends his detail off a lot. He's actually said to them that he doesn't want to put them in a position where they'd have to..." "Gotcha," Pat nodded. "And they have to play along?" "No choice. He's meeting with people, but we don't always know who, and we're not allowed to find out what he's doing against swordsmen." A wry shake of the head. "Don't you love it?" "I like Ryan." His eyes scanned the area looking for trouble. It was automatic, just like breathing. "We love the guy," Norm agreed. "We think he's going to make it. Chiulte's full of crap. Hey, I worked his detail back when he was VP, okay? I fucking stood post outside the door while he was inside boffin' some cookie or other. Part of the job," he concluded sourly. The two federal agents shared a look. This was an inside story, to be repeated only within the federal law enforcement community. And while the Secret Service was paid to protect their principles and keep all the secrets, that didn't mean they liked it. "I think you're right. So, things here okay?" "Russell wants 3 more people, but I don't think he's going to get it. Hell, we have 3 good agents inside and 3 doing overwatch next door." He wasn't revealing anything. O'Day had figured that one out. "And, yeah, across the street. Russell looks like he knows his stuff." "Grandpa's the best," Norm offered. "Hell, he's trained half the people in the service. And you ought to see him shoot. Both hands." O'Day smiled. "People keep telling me that. One day I'll have to invite him over for a friendly match." A grin. "Andrea told me. She, pulled your bureau file." "What?" "Hey, Pat, it's business. We check everybody out. We have a principal in here every day, you dig?" Norm Jeffers went on. "Besides, she wanted to see your firearms card. I hear you're pretty decent, but I'm telling you, man, you want to play with Russell. Bring money, you hear?" "That's what makes a horse race, Mr. Jeffers." O'Day loved such challenges, and he'd yet to lose one. "Bet your white ass, Mr. O'Day." His hand went up. He checked his earpiece, then his watch. "They just started moving. Sandbox is on the way. Our kid and your kid are real buddies." "She seems like a great little girl." "They're all good kids. A couple of rough spots, but that's kids. Shadow is going to be a handful when she starts dating for real." "I don't want to hear it." Jeffers had a good laugh. "Yeah, I'm hoping ours will be a boy. My dad, he's a city police captain in Atlanta, he says that daughters are God's punishment on you for being a man. You live in fear that they'll meet somebody like you were at 17. "Enough. Let me go to work and deal with some criminals." He slapped Jeffers on the shoulder. "She'll be here when you get back, Pat." O'Day passed on the usual coffee refill across Ritchie Highway, instead heading south to Route 50. He had to admit that the service guys knew their stuff. But there was at least one aspect of presidential security that the Bureau was handling. He'd have to talk to the OPR guys this morning. Informally, of course. One died, one went home, and at roughly the same time. It was McGregor's first Ebola death. He'd seen enough others, heart attack failures to resuscitate, strokes,
cancer, or just old age. More often than not, doctors weren't there, and the job fell on nurses. But he was there for this one. At the end, it wasn't so much peace as exhaustion.